Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Anna Kogal from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Glamour and Vogue magazines. Well, welcome back, everyone. Today is August 15th. Hope you had a great summer and hope you're still enjoying this warm weather and getting out. Today we do have quite a bit of interesting articles, some shorter ones, not as many long ones. I'm sorry, I had some quite long ones the last couple of times. But we're going to start off today with Vogue, and there is an article on graphic design. Lucia Pica's newest makeup collection for Chanel is a tribute to the cinematic romance of Paris and one of the brand's most iconic codes. Under the soaring ceilings of the Grand Palais, two Italian brunettes are chattering at warp speed. The 20-year-old model Vittoria Ceretti, a muse of the late Karl Lagerfeld, is having her makeup done for Chanel's recent cruise show, while Lucia Pica, the house's global creative makeup and color designer, shares a few instructional words with her team. Fresca, leggera, ordinata. Fresher, lighter, neater. On top of a sheer natural base, Pica is using a steady hand to deliver the runway's unexpected statement, an intensely glossy black lip. The collection is also Virginie Viard's first solo outing as Chanel's newly named creative director, and she is in the early stages of putting her own stamp on Karl's and Coco's legacy. But if her first and last looks, an easy jacket with cropped wide leg pants and a halter dress suspended from a stiff Edwardian collar, both in combinations of black and white, are any indication, certain Soignée codes will always remain a part of the brand's DNA, both on the runway and backstage. Black and white are very Chanel, Pica says, of the inspiration behind Noir and Blanc, her new range out this month. But I wanted to add a little more intensity, strength, and attitude, she says, a twisting of tradition that has become her signature. In her 4 years on the job, the Naples-born makeup artist, who spends most of her time in Paris these days, has mastered the art of steering treasured Chanel touchstones toward something more modern and cool. Her ability to place pigments where they're least expected is the stuff of legend. Red for your eyelids? Bien sûr! An emoji yellow nail polish that can flatter every skin tone? Pourquoi non? But with its roots in the cinematic, often stark romanticism of her adopted hometown, Pica's latest creation is something of a departure. Paris is the most black and white city that you can imagine, the 42-year-old says, staring onto the Messiaen courtyard of Chanel HQ in Neuilly-sur-Seine, just 20 minutes outside of the city. Seemingly makeup-free, save for an intense burgundy lip, Pica taps a pair of black over-the-knee boots as she continues to unpack this idea. You can't miss the graphic modernist architecture, the Pompidou, La Défense, Le Grand Arch, and the Art Deco, ebony and ivory towers, she explains in a soft accent, adding the pre-technicolor films of the Nouvelle Vague to her mental mood board. Pica's challenge, as she explains it, was to find the colors in the light beneath the black. That light exists all over the French capital, in the symmetrical formal flower beds of the Jardin du Luxembourg and the cobbled alleys of Le Marais, which Pica carefully studied before conceptualizing a single eyeshadow palette. Her creative process relies on documenting her surroundings with an outsider's eye. Reflections on the Seine at night, a honeycomb shadow on naked flesh, in partnership with a different photographer every season. Then I look at the colors, asking, which will make a good lipstick or eyeshadow? Just as Coco surrounded herself with Picabia, Cocteau, Bakst, and Stravinsky, Pica moves in a creative clique that led her to Los Angeles-based photographer Max Farrago and his wife, the director Clara Cullen. Over 4 days, the trio buccaneered around the left bank, capturing an abstract vision of the Bohemian enclave before rewarding themselves with a little organic wine and cheese at La Crèmerie, Pica's local. I like these morbid colors, she says, flipping past an image of a wilted tulip that inspired the deep mauve of Rouge Obscur, one of the two velvet extreme lipsticks in the line, which she layered on Ceretti underneath, that high-shine licorice stick, aptly called Lac Noir. I think this could be good on everyone, she continues, of the deceptively dark black cherry color. Le Gel Pelleté, a bouncy transparent cream with a gold shimmer, has similarly universal appeal. It can be swept across cheekbones, dotted on lids, or used to create an all-over twilight veil. A twilight veil à la Romy Schneider's shimmering turn in Henri Georges Clouzot's 1964 film Inferno. If everybody puts makeup on the same way, we're all going to look the same, Pica insists, issuing an open invitation to experiment and underscoring a heritage that she is determined to make her own. Coco was a rebel, she says breezily, of the woman who gave us the little black dress. But it's Pica we have to thank for the little black lip gloss. And I have to add that in the picture here, we have a young woman with an extremely short-cropped haircut, very close to her head and ears revealed. And she's looking down. She's got some mascara on with some eyeliner heading straight out, streaking back towards her ears. And above her black eyeliner is, are her eyebrows, black eyebrows. And right above the black eyebrows are two white streaks. So just white streaks along the same lines as her black eyebrows are. Very interesting. Kind of neat looking. Alrighty. Well, we're going to go on from there to glamour. Troyan Belisario on her life after anorexia. This is me after 10 years of recovery. Troyan Belisario knows her new film, Feed, F-E-E-D, is not going to be easy for fans to watch. I really wanted people to be frightened by the experience, she says of her passion project, which she wrote, produced, and stars in. Out today on streaming and video on demand. I want people to understand that this is a dangerous illness, and it means fighting for your life. It's partly why she wanted the film's title to be in all caps. Seeing the title treatment like that captured that image, that it's life or death, and the title becomes How Do We Nourish Each Other? And what does it mean to feed this thing inside you and watch it grow as you yourself start to waste away? There's a reason the Pretty Little Liars alum feels so strongly about this topic. Having battled anorexia beginning in her late teens, Belisario, 31, knows firsthand the pain this disease can cause. It's consistent therapy, she says, of keeping the disorder in check, as well as choosing to consistently return to health, because you have so much to live for. Belisario opened up to Glamour about her road to recovery and the story she wanted to tell with the film. Glamour. The term eating disorder is used a lot, but not always understood. How do you feel about it? Troyon Belisario. I have thought about it, and since I've been working with the National Eating Disorders Association, I learned that 20 million women and 10 million men in America at some point in their life will go through an engagement with an eating disorder. When I was younger and going through treatment, I was like, everybody has a weird relationship with food. My mom does, my dad does, so why am I the one that is struggling so hard? A lot of people talk to me about disordered eating versus having an eating disorder. And that's an important distinction. I hate to put a label on anything, but it's an important umbrella term under which there are many different subcategories and experiences that people can have. You can have a disordered relationship with food, but to have an eating disorder is indicative of a mental illness, which I think needs treatment and recognition in a different way. Glamour. Exactly. So many people struggle with food and body image. I don't know one human being who has been perfectly happy with their body all the time. TB, that can't be expected in this day and age, particularly with every representation that we have in the media. That was a big thing for me, and why I wanted to make feed so much. A lot of my experience through social media and being an actor was I have so many young women and men reach out to me and say, oh my gosh, you're so perfect. And look at this photo. You look perfect. And not only is that a lot of pressure for me, but it's a misrepresentation. This is me with 2.5 hours of hair and makeup. This is me after 10 years of therapy for recovery. I am not perfect. I'm moving through something every single day, and so is everybody else. That deserves to be recognized. Glamour, when you were writing the script, how much did you pull from your own life? TB, definitely the perfectionistic qualities. I felt a lot of pressure in high school to perform at really high levels. I pushed myself in order to do that, which was a huge part of my illness. There are parts of me that are in Olivia, but there are a lot of other parts of other people that have shared their stories with me. What I've noticed is that we share a lot of the same feelings, even though our lives are totally different. The voice sounded the same in a lot of ways, and it was just as powerful for somebody that could have a totally different race or gender. Glamour, have your parents seen the film yet? TB, my father saw it, and my mother is going to watch it with me for the first time, but she read the script. My dad said that he thought what I did was brave and that he was proud of me. When my mother read the script, it did exactly what I wanted, which is when I was going through this with my parents and my brothers, they did not understand. They were like, why can't you just eat? You're putting your life in danger. You can't go to school. We've had interventions. Why can't you just eat? and I couldn't communicate it to them. After my mother read the script, it was like suddenly, like, oh my God. It had nothing to do with your weight, and it was about this and about control. Everything I had been trying to communicate to them was suddenly clear because they were able to watch it and see it from my point of view. So I felt really grateful. Glamour, you started writing Feed about 8 years ago. I'd imagine there's both pros and cons that it took so long to get that made. TB, yeah, and I'm really glad it happened this way. I wrote Feed 3 months before I booked Pretty Little Liars, and then it was 7 years of me trying to make Feed during my hiatuses, getting money together, finding the right producer, director, the cast. Every single time I was like, is it never supposed to happen? Should I not put this story out there? And then finally, when everything came together, the way that it did, and with Pretty Little Liars ending, and all of a sudden, me getting to come out with the story, and me having a whole fan base that is so open and receptive to everything that I do, which I'm so grateful, it was like, oh, that's why. That's why it didn't happen for 8 years. I want this story to reach out and affect as many people as possible, and be seen by as many people as possible. And I don't think it would have been able to do that without my fan base being built up over 8 years. I'm incredibly grateful. What do you want people to know about what to say to someone going through an eating disorder, and once they're in recovery, too? TB, for people that are watching somebody struggle, I think it's really important to convey to them that you don't want to lose them. One of the most painful things is when people say, just eat this, or put on the weight and you'll be better. That in no way is true. Also, there are so many people that are suffering from eating disorders that look healthy, who you might not think have a problem at all. It's important to have the patience and the empathy to sit with someone and say, I know that you are going through a lot. Glamour, having been through the worst of it, what coping techniques do you live by so you don't fall back into old habits? How do you make sure you stay in a good place? TB, therapy is really important. Consistent therapy. Particularly shooting this film where I had to lose weight and engage with those demons, it was something that all my friends and family were like, we're not going to let you walk back into this without taking it very, very seriously. For me, I'm still finding that out. One interesting thing about this mental disorder is that when you behave in these patterns, they create neural pathways in your brain. It's difficult not to be consistently defaulting to them. And so that's why recovery takes so long, because you literally have to create new neural pathways. Over my almost decade of recovery, I've been able to create those pathways, but that doesn't mean that the thoughts and the compulsions are not still very present. It's about making the choice to consistently return to health, to consistently reinvest in your life, because you have so much to live for. I think reminding myself of that, reminding myself that I couldn't have the relationship that I have now with my husband and have that relationship with the eating disorder. And I want to be able to have a full life, a full career. And that was a huge thing for me. I can't enact other roles or areas of my life if my health is in poor shape. All right, and as we are wrapping up summer, well, we've got summer through September, I think, honestly. But Here's an article from Glamour entitled Sneaky Skin Cancer Risks to Know Now. So, yeah, we've got a lot of sunshine left. Skin cancer is terrifyingly common. 20% of Americans will eventually get some form of it, and more than 36,000 women will be diagnosed with melanoma, the deadliest type, this year. Most of us know the best prevention. Wear sunscreen daily. Stay out of the sun during peak hours, that's 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., FYI. Avoid the literal deathbeds that are tanning salons. Okay, easy enough. But other things up your risk too. Keep reading to get smart about four more culprits. One, surprising risk factor, your HPV status. There are more than 100 types of HPV, and you've probably heard a lot of about the ones that are sexually transmitted and increase the risk of cervical cancer. But certain other kinds affect your skin. They are common and can cause dry, itchy patches or warts. Early research has found that these may also increase your risk of squamous cell cancer if they are exposed to UV light. Here's why. Any sort of process that causes long-term inflammation on the skin has the possibility of spurring squamous cell carcinomas, says San Diego dermatologist Melanie Palm, MD. If skin is infected with HPV, and exposed to a lot of sun, you are creating two scenarios that can wear down DNA and cause cellular damage that might lead to skin cancer. So, if you've got a questionable patch, have your doctor check it out. If it's HPV, she may simply recommend that you be extra vigilant about the usual sun safety measures. In severe cases, topical chemotherapy creams and photodynamics therapy are used, says NYC dermatologist Ellen Marmer, MD. They fight the HPV-infected cells before they can mutate into cancer. Two, surprising risk factor, your umbrella habit. Sitting in the shade or under an umbrella is smart, but it's not enough. A recent study in Texas compared people who applied SPF 100 with those who sat under umbrellas and found the umbrella group had triple the incidence of burns. People get a false sense of security under umbrellas, Dr. Palm says. At the beach, the sand and water are reflecting light. You're not in a vacuum. You still get plenty of the sun's rays, Dr. Marmer says, and you still need sunscreen. Apply it before you go out, a shot glass worth for your entire body. Remember your hands, neck, ears, and hairline, and reapply every 2 hours. And should it be SPF 100? Researchers in Colorado found that SPF 100 protected skiers better than SPF 50, but that didn't settle the debate among derms as to what is the best SPF number. One reason, high SPF levels can make people think they can skip other sun safety steps. You need a multi-pronged approach. Number three. Surprising risk factor, your social media feed. In 2015, a Kentucky woman named Tawny Willoughby posted of her blistered face as it was healing from skin cancer treatment, and the post went viral. It was enough to prompt researchers to ask whether social media could increase skin cancer awareness. They found that it can. During the month people were sharing that photo, Google searches for skin cancer prevention hit near record levels. I wish I had seen a photo like that when I was younger, Dr. Palm says. It really makes an impression on people who think they'll never get skin cancer. Unfortunately, Our feeds tend more toward yoga on the beach and glistening infinity pools, which doesn't make you want to hide in the shade. Maybe it's not so sexy to pose in UPF clothing, Dr. Palm admits, but chewing up your collagen and putting yourself at risk isn't the best look either. Joshua Zeichner, MD, a New York dermatologist, believes social media could make SPF more appealing. If the message is that it's cool to use sunscreen, then hopefully people will do it. Try following sunsafe brands like Supergoop and chic UPF clothing lines Mott 50 and Cover, which make skin health share-worthy. And finally, number four, surprising risk factor, your poolside rosé. Last year, a study published in the British Journal of Dermatology found that daily alcohol intake can increase your skin cancer risk, and the more drinks you have, the higher your risk. Other research has found that alcohol lowers antioxidant levels in your body, which means you have less natural protection against UV rays. But Derms Glamour said the biggest hazard is how drinking impacts your decision making. You just don't make the best choices after a few cocktails, Dr. Zeichner says. You may not get out of the sun when you should, or be as diligent at applying sunscreen. And there's the rub, the burn. Okay, real quick, Joe Knows, supermodel approved trainer Joe Holder gives a masterclass on long, lithe legs in 5 easy steps. 1, soft tissue mobilization gets the body moving correctly, and that's when great things happen. 2, Holder's cardio warm-up of choice is jumping rope circuit of 30-second intervals, alternating between faster and slower paces for at least 10 minutes, followed by a 10-minute run or brisk walk on the treadmill at an incline. This really increases muscle elasticity. 3, once the blood is pumping, Holder focuses on a targeted trio of butt-busting mat moves in reps of 10, bird dogs extending the opposite arm and leg in unison, fire hydrants raising one leg at a right angle out to the side until your thigh is parallel to the floor, and single leg elevated side planks with the top foot placed on a bench to work the glutes and adductors as the body lifts. All right, we're going to have to keep it at that. Well, we have run out of time for today's episode of Teen Magazines. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Annika Gall, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. I hope you make it a great week, and I'll see you next week.